Good morning and welcome to Backchat. I'm Sarah Passmore.
And I'm Hugh Chiverton. Today we ask whether the land sales are good news for Hong Kong.
Tuesday's $10 billion land sale has not only boosted the government's coffers, but according to most analysts, has also stoked the property market. Developers have already been marking up new flats.
Well, the director of land says there's no risk at the moment of a property bubble, and many think the prices reflect a healthy, confident economy.
But there are also those who worry that the government could be tempted to be over-reliant on land sales and say that land supply should be increased along with a broader tax base.
Not forgetting those who want to buy their own flats and simply can't afford it.
So just who benefits when property prices go up and who suffers when they go down?
Call us with your thoughts, your questions. 233 88266 is the number, or you can email backchat at rthk.org.hk. And over in our central studio, we have at the moment Peter Churchhouse, the director of Lim Advisors, a property expert, David Webb, who's the editor of website.com, and Christopher Mills, assistant director in the lands department. David, I know you're keen on disclosure and putting all your cards on the table. So I should say my wife is an estate agent, first of all. Okay, so we'll start with that. Christopher Mills, are you pleased with the land sale on Tuesday?
Yes, I think my views reflect the consensus in the market and what was reported yesterday. We're very pleased that the auction went off very smoothly, and that there was considerable bidding in the auction room. I think for one of the sites we had something like 77 bids, and there were 10 potential bidders putting their hands up. That's quite a healthy sign, I think, for the market, that there was open, free competition in a transparent forum, and we achieved very reasonable prices. I think we saw in the paper yesterday comments and photographs of the purchase of these lots, very pleased with their acquisitions, and I think it reflects the developers' positive outlook for the market.
Also pictures of agents changing their prices, putting their prices up 5, 8, 10% even. Are you interested in those? Do you care about that, or is that what happens after the auction is not your concern?
I think really the whole idea about the auction is to allow the developers to come in and purchase land and for them to interpret the way they see the future market. If then the existing market chooses to use that as a barometer to elevate their prices, it's really beyond the control of Lands Department.
Mm-hmm. Peter Churchhouse, were you pleased with the results?
Yes, it was certainly a little bit higher than I had expected. But I think it probably reflects the perception that the developers have that the property market is going to tighten over the next couple of years. Production of housing is forecast to drop a couple of years out, down to about 16, 17,000 units per year from a long-term average of between 27 and 30,000 units a year. So it looks like the market's going to get tight, and I think anybody who studies those numbers would suggest that those upside momentum will be maintained in property prices, and that's the reason I think you're seeing the relatively high prices at the land auction.
Tight because there'll be less land sold by the government?
Well, there's been less land sold historically over the recent years, and it takes 3 to 4 years for any of these major sites in Hong Kong to come on stream. From the time you acquire the site till the time the property is completed can be a 3 or 4 year time lag. So the production at 2 years out looks like it's going to drop to around half of the long-term average. So I think that's one of the factors that's in people's minds who actually know these numbers and study these figures.
But that pleases you, does it?
Well, it pleases me as a property owner, perhaps, but it worries me if I were trying to get onto the housing ladder, because housing in Hong Kong in absolute terms is expensive. Only 50-odd percent of the population actually own their own home, or less than. So I would be concerned from a social point of view, but as a homeowner, I'm quite pleased.
All right, let's bring in now Eric Lee, senior partner with Lee Tang Chen and Company. Also, Eric, I gather you're a non-executive director of Sun & Gay, is that right?
That's correct, yes.
Okay, right.
But I don't actually act as a spokesman for the company, though.
Sure, okay, that's understood. All right, what do you make of the land sale, the prices?
Well, I think that's surprisingly high. Actually, I think we were expecting the land sales to be good, but I think that it also exceeded some expectation. But it does reflect that the developers are still very optimistic about the future of property prices. I think for particularly large property developer, they'll be looking much more at the average cost of their land bank rather than one or two individual pieces of land that they're buying. In that terms, I think they're certainly seeing that property prices should be sustained at a fairly high level for the foreseeable future.
Are they, because the land price is very much related to the supply, which is controlled pretty much by the government, are developers, when they bid, are they betting on what the government are going to be doing in the future when it comes to releasing
well,
land?
Well, not in the present way that the supply of land is being made out. They're always put in the reserve list and waiting to be bid, I think, before they come up for a public auction. But I think the government do set the reserve price, though. And certainly the developer has been complaining in the past few years that the reserve price has been somewhat higher than what they had wanted. So it's not entirely a free market, so to speak. I think the government does set a very minimum price before the land can be sold, so that it doesn't goes out very, very cheaply. In that sense, it helps to sustain or maintain a reasonably sustainable value for land prices that is to be sold out.
A sustainable value. A sustainable value for land prices. What does that mean?
Well, what I mean is that it doesn't fall too drastically, too suddenly. It's been kept at a certain level because government would not sell the land if it fall below a certain level.
Right. Let's now bring in David Webb from website.com. David, were you pleased with what did you make of that price paid?
Well, I guess it's what the market will bear, but I think that the bigger issue is whether we need to reform the way in which we sell these public assets. At the moment, we require an entire upfront lump sum payment for the right to develop the land, and there aren't too many people with $4 billion or $6 billion in their pockets able to participate in that kind of auction. The consequence of it is that it restricts the development for large sites of that type to a relatively small number of very large developers, and that tends to restrict competition. The result of all that is basically a cartel, which the government is clearly afraid of, which is why they have abandoned previous systems of regularly auctioning off land on a schedule, and instead they now have the reserve list and require that they have a minimum bid of at least 80% of what they think the market value of the land is before they will start an auction, just in case they otherwise would face an auction ring, which happened once in the 90s during the Patton regime, where a group of 11 developers got together and agreed to bid jointly as a consortium so that there were virtually no other bids on the table. Now, I think that it should be reformed to introduce stage payments for land over a long period of time, perhaps 25 years, so that you can then reduce the barriers to entry to smaller developers and make the market more competitive, whilst at the same time stabilising the income that the government receives from the land, because they would be almost guaranteed to receive that future stream of lease payments on the land. What we have at the moment is basically a very feudal system, rather like the Middle Ages in England, where a few large landlords collect taxes indirectly for the government by collecting the price of property and then paying land premiums to the government. And it's a very inefficient form of tax collection because, of course, the developers take out a very large margin on the way through. So although Hong Kong claims to have very low tax rates on salaries and profits tax, in fact, what we have is a very inefficient indirect taxation system. So there's a number of reasons why reform is needed.
But land is of a premium. That's the thing we always hear in Hong Kong. How do you change the system? How do you help the smaller developers?
Well, as I say, I think you need to shift to a system of stage payments on the land auctions, so that what you're bidding for is how much you will pay every year for the next 25 years on the land that you're buying.
And what's in it for the government to do that?
What's in it is in the public interest that it would increase competition, probably overall reduce the price of property, but it would certainly increase competition between developers and reduce the margins of the giant developers that currently dominate the market. As it's about a handful of companies that take up 75 to 80% of new flat sales.
Christopher Mills, what have you considered that?
it's not really being considered in any great detail. I mean, David's talking about a larger picture of the tax structure and Hong Kong reliance on land sales and that kind of thing. I think in terms of what we're offering in the application list, we are offering smaller sites for the smaller developers to come in. We deliberately do include smaller sites to give them the opportunity to do that. I would have thought that without any consultation with the developers, I would have thought, and I wouldn't like to speak on their behalf, but I would have thought they probably wouldn't like this idea because that would be committing them to a phase of payments over a long period of time. And I'm sure they would prefer to pay for an asset like an expensive piece of land, knowing the value on the day and knowing that they can then develop that land and gain a profit in 3 or 4 years' time down the road. I see that there would be a lot of uncertainty and it would depress the value of the sale tremendously, apart from anything else.
Mr. Churchhouse, do you think that's true?
If you go back 15 or 20 years, in fact 25 years, the government used to have stage payment systems for land, not over 25 years, but you could pay the land off over a few years during the development period. The government abandoned that in favour of the upfront payment scheme. But I would agree with David that the land sales system in Hong Kong, I think, is worthy of reform because you end up with a relatively small number of players in the system, and it is relatively uncompetitive in that sense. However, I think it's going to be very hard for government to change this system because it relies so much on land premium, land sales, land use changes, property taxes of one kind or another. Up to 30-32% of the government's budget is from something to do with land, and that's a very high number. So it is, I think, it's going to be very difficult for government to actually change that that system. And of course, we are thinking in terms of goods and services tax, VAT taxes, to smooth out the revenue system. But land policy in Hong Kong is effectively fiscal policy, and I think it's going to be a little difficult for government to shift fundamentally from that basic policy.
Because the alternative is less stable.
The alternatives are probably more stable in terms of government revenue. That's the whole point, is that because you're so reliant on it.
What's the difficulty for the government in shifting
I just think they conceptually have a major problem with a shift like this.
The difficulty is that the chief executive is elected by tycoons who have a strong interest in keeping the system as it is.
Yeah, and, you know, what's wrong with the system as it is? It is stable, isn't it? And we do have extremely low tax rates.
It's not stable in the sense of government revenues. As you've seen in recent years, we've had this massive fall in property prices. We saw property prices fall from 97 through to 203 by 65%. Government revenues from land fell very dramatically indeed, and it was a major factor behind the budget deficits in Hong Kong. So the whole idea to move to a more smooth and balanced revenue system for government, I think right at the root of this is the reliance on property and property-related sources of revenue for the government. And I think a lot of people in the community are talking about ways of smoothing that out and lessening the reliance on land, and the idea of having some kind of profits tax on land, similar to what you have in the UK, rather than this upfront premium, I think is being mooted. But I don't see any serious discussion in government on this.
The property market, so however you do it, is always going to be a bit of a gamble, isn't it, as a revenue maker?
Oh, absolutely. Property is a very cyclical business. And in Hong Kong, it's even more cyclical because of the link to the linked currency to the US, which means we end up with having inappropriate interest rate policies from time to time, as we had in the early 90s. When the U.S. was lowering interest rates in the face of a recession, Hong Kong was booming with 12% inflation and interest rates at 5%. That means we have a property bubble in that kind of environment. So we end up, because of the peg to a large extent, having a more volatile property market than you would otherwise have, typically, and also much more volatile revenues for government.
But we're very well off in Hong Kong. We're very rich, and we do have low taxes, and we've sustained those low taxes pretty much. I mean, even through the hard times, we've still got enormous reserves. We've still got, you know, great public facilities. We've got half the population living in public housing. We've got free education, blah blah blah, and so on. We're still very well off. And isn't that because the government has the land and keeps and controls the sale of the land? It's a real asset.
No, we're well off because of the opening up of China since 1978. I think that's the biggest factor in our economic development.
If a third of our income comes from
land. I don't agree with the proposition that we have low taxes when you include all of the tax that we pay on land premiums.
And other half taxes. The population don't pay that at all, do they?
Half the population don't, the other half do.
If you look at the
total share of GDP that the government occupies, it is by no means low, given that we don't have any defence obligations or any foreign diplomatic obligations. As a territory, being as compact as we are, we ought to be incredibly efficient on the governmental level, but we're not.
It's 10 minutes to 9. You're listening to Backchat this morning. We're talking about land sales and whether or not they're good for Hong Kong. 233 88266 is the number to call if you have any views to share with us. Herman has called. He says, every time we have a land sale, the government and property analysts always say, don't worry, there's no property bubble developing. Consumer confidence is good, etc. Well, he says, that's all very well for the property developer. What about the ordinary member of public? Our rents are going up, interest rates are going up. Protection of tenants has just been stripped to make it easier for landlords to kick tenants out. The poor and the middle class will never benefit from this so-called boom. Eric Lee, what do you make of that?
Well, I think we raised a lot of very complicated problems just now.
Yeah,
I think
we'll sort them out later.
Yeah, but I think the property market in Hong Kong is an extremely mature market. It's not simply the local people buying homes for its own use. I think it's a very much investment market from a lot of overseas buyer. So a lot of land sales or super prices of land sale and property sale are taken up by people from perhaps from the mainland and from other parts of overseas. So in some way, they're indirectly contributing.
Surely it's local developers who usually buy these.
They buy the land, but I think what they've done to the land is to add value to it by the property development, and that's where they make the profit. They don't just sell the land by cutting it into pieces. They have to add value to it before they can be sold. I think the main thing is not for the government to maintain a reasonable, stable property price, and not to use the land as an instrument to ensure sort of even out revenue for itself. I think that will be itself a very debatable, I would say, not a very right objective for the government. I think the government should be very careful not to try to meddle with the land prices. I think different government, like the Hong Kong government or the UK government, has tried it. But if the government tried to become a reverie of our property prices, they're doomed to failure.
But this is a red herring, because the land is all the government's to sell. I mean, of course they control the prices.
I think that that's how I think the government eventually settle on the present system, is by allowing land to be taken out by developer on the need, on the demand on the market, and then they'll be auctioned publicly to fetch what is the correct market or what is the free market price. I think that's perhaps the best that the government can do, by not trying to interfere or try to referee too much on the market.
What about just having a schedule of sales? I mean, that's really standing back, isn't it? You just say we're going
to... Yes, I think we've tried that. I think that's exactly what had happened before, by using a schedule of land, projecting the number of property to be completed in a certain number of years. And at the end of the day, what happened? The property prices collapsed for a long period of time.
Okay, they collapse. I mean, yeah. if you're really just letting the market run it, then they might collapse, they might not. But you just say, we're going to sell this now, this, with this timetable.
Yeah, but I think the collapse is taken much longer, is much more severe. If the government tried to artificially depress the property price, the property sector probably account in terms of government revenue, something like 40% of the whole government revenue, directly and indirectly. And to try to find some substitute for it, like what we tried to do a few years back, is virtually impossible. Unless we introduce something very drastic, like a very high percentage of sales tax and things. So without having a good plan, a workable plan in its place, unfortunately, we're rather stuck with the present system we have.
Okay, you're saying 40% of the...
Directly and indirectly, yes.
Right, okay.
Including stamp duties and so on.
Right, yeah.
And the professionals and other people working in with the sector.
Right.
So I think you have to take you up on your... You've said it two or three times about the supply and price being controlled by government. The whole idea behind the application list is government stepping back and allowing developers to trigger and show their interest and to therefore supply the right land to the marketplace, allow the market to have its voice. The price of the land is set by the bidding in the auction room, and as I said before, we had for one site 77 bids from 10 or 11 developers. That is a very transparent, competitive situation. The market price is set in the auction room by the bidders.
Well, in most auctions you have a reserve price, maybe, but you still put them up for auction. You don't wait until you get a bid before you Before you put something up for sale, you say, I mean, you have a schedule, don't you? And that's what, you know, we used to have. Surely that's stepping back even more, isn't it?
Well, it's not really, because then government's deciding the sites to be sold. The application list system, the beauty of it is that the developers, the market, is deciding which sites they're interested in.
And they know. One thing that isn't clear to me is if the application list starts to get short, is it automatic that you will top it up and expand the amount of land available? And if so, aren't you affecting the supply?
It's not automatic at all. In fact, we would resist that. But of course, if we had a small list of, say, 10 sites and we sold all 10 sites in the first 3 months, we would obviously look at the balance of the 9 months, and we would obviously expect to be putting a supply to the market. On the current list, we've got 35 sites. We've only just sold three. I don't see the opportunity for thinking about topping up.
And will you be increasing your... I mean, you'll be taking the results of this last land sale into account when you set the minimum price for the next... lots, won't you?
I think like anybody, any valuer, anybody in the marketplace will take all relevant statistics and information into account. The recent land auction is one ingredient in the cake, if you like. There are a lot of others, including the secondary market and private land sales, interest rates, whatever. This is certainly one of the factors that would be taken into account.
Do you try and get as much money as you can from sales?
Of course.
You just want to maximise the price.
Well, basically, that's we're instructed to do
sure,
so. We maximise revenue and development potential.
Mm. All right. We've had an email from Mark, who has a different perspective. He says, aside from the auction itself being conducted like a game of bingo, he quotes the auctioneer, Sandy Patton, as at one point actually cajoling bidders with, come on, you ladies, any interest from the little ladies at the back? The reaction from estate agents and developers has been typical of Hong Kong's blinkered business leaders. A sickening, greedy cash-in. That comes from Mark. David, in response to that?
No. I think the market in under the current system, which I have criticised, drives the price. And there is the issue of... whether the market is too cyclical because of its structure, but I don't think we can say that the auction was anything other than a transparent process.
Okay, we've had another email from JB. It's addressed to you, David, although maybe Christopher Mills should address it as well. JB says, why wouldn't the developers prefer stage payments over 25 years for their purchase of land? They could use the funds for their own purpose, or at least avoid interest payments to the banks. Isn't it the government that doesn't want that system?
I think it's the large developers that don't want that system, because over the last 25 years, they've had very rich profit margins from being the dominant players in the market. And to some extent, being able to control, either through political or through financial means, the release of property to the market. So it would, to introduce a lower barrier to entry would break down some of those barriers and expand the number of players in the market, and that's likely to result in greater efficiencies in the development process and smaller profit margins.
Christopher Mills, are you scared of the big developers?
I'm not scared of the big developers. We liaise and consult with them, deal with them all the time in transactions, negotiating with them. We know them fairly well. It's not a question of being scared of anybody.
Political ways in which the developers have affected land supply was the way in which, during the slump, the government suddenly changed its policy and told the NTRC, which is a public listed company, to stop any further tendering of land on its railway projects, and likewise KCRC, and at the same time lent on the government, which then suspended sales of home ownership scheme flats. And there are still thousands of empty flats decaying in our humid atmosphere and not occupied because they've been held back in order to prop up the property market. And that's because the developers wanted to release their inventory, which they'd acquired at relatively high land prices during the late 90s, onto the market.
Okay, have it ye. That's David Webb. We've got a break for 5 minutes for the news, but we'll be back talking about the land sales and about land sale policy in general and the economy in Hong Kong. I want to know your thoughts, your questions, your comments. Weather forecast before the news, mainly fine. One or two isolated showers. Maximum temperature about 30 degrees. The outlook mainly fine for the rest of the week. 26 degrees at the moment with the relative humidity now of 87%. The air pollution index forecast for today for general stations, it's medium to high, and for roadside stations today the outlook is high.
You're listening to Backchat on Radio 3. Call us on 233-88266 or email backchat@rthk.org.hk. It's your voice.
Welcome back to Back Chat with me, Sarah Passmore, and Hugh Chiverton. This morning, we're talking about land sales and property prices and all the rest of it in Hong Kong. We'd like to hear your views, so do give us a call. That number again, 233-88266. We're joined this morning by Christopher Mills, who is the Assistant Director for the Lands Department, David Webb, the editor of website.com, Peter Churchhouse, Director of Lim Advisors, and Eric Lee, a Senior Partner with Lee Tang Cheng and Co. Peter, Centreline has given a figure since July 2003. The average property price has gone up by 74%. Is that not a bubble? Is it sustainable? We can't hear you. Could someone open the mics? Can you start again?
That's right, Sarah. But I think you tend to forget that property prices in this 97 to 2003 period fell by 60 to 70%. You try and imagine that happening in the US or the UK, you'd have financial mayhem if that happened in that environment.
But they had been very high before that.
Well, that's right. This is a very volatile market, and it's a very volatile market for a number of reasons, partly driven, as I mentioned earlier, by the pegged currency, automatically creates greater volatility. However, I don't think we're in bubble phase just yet at all. Housing is still very affordable in terms of housing cost in relation to household incomes and so on. We're a long way from the bubble territory we saw back in 1997.
Is it really?
Oh, yes.
I mean, if you look at the South China Morning Post, has got a property section, just flicking through it this morning. Mm-hmm. There are properties in there for 29 million, 39 million. Yes, is that really affordable for the average Hong Konger?
You tend to forget that represents less than 3% of the total housing stock. Basically, 85% of housing in Hong Kong is less than 700 square feet. And all the headlines in the press tend to focus on the luxury upper end of the market. Apartments in Hong Kong over 1,700 square feet, which is what that article largely focuses on, represents about 3 to 3.5% of the total housing stock. We tend to forget that it's this vast array of units under 700 square feet, which is really what most people are looking at in Hong Kong. And that is still pretty affordable if you look at it in terms of household income and prices. We're still 40 or 50% down from where we were in 1997. So, yes, I think property prices are headed upwards because of the tight supply over the next couple of years and may lead to a bubble, just like it is in the US and just like it has been in Australia and in the UK. But I'm not saying we're there yet. It just looks like we could be headed in that direction.
But it's the nature, you're saying, of the market in Hong Kong is to boom and bust like that.
Very, very much so. And it's because we have this restricted land supply and because we have an interest rate policy in Hong Kong which is not governed by our own central bank. Our interest rate policy is governed by Mr. Greenspan, and that means we can have at times interest rates which are too high for our local market, which was the case in 98 and 99, which hurts the market, and then at other times we can have interest rates that are too low, and therefore that tends to drive property prices upwards. So we automatically have this, it's a volatile business anyway in any normal market, let alone in Hong Kong where we have this even more volatile system because of the pegged currency.
Does it really work like that? Can you plot interest rates against prices?
Absolutely. I mean, this is the key factors that Mr. Greenspan is worried about in the US.
But in Hong Kong, I mean, interest rates have been going up for the last... how long it is, a couple of years, and so have the prices.
Yeah, but we had, if you think back in the early 90s, we had interest rates heading down during that period, and inflation running at 12% and interest rates at 7%. People in Hong Kong are pretty smart. They look around and say, hey, here's a good way to make money, buy property, because inflation, property normally goes at least in line with inflation, and so people did make a lot of money when we had that interest rate discrepancy. 5 years, we had interest rates less than the rate of inflation, and people will, in that kind of environment, will buy solid assets like real estate, also stocks. You don't have that situation in most normal markets because you have a central bank that governs interest rate policy for that market. We have to inherit Mr. Greenspan's policy, and it's not always appropriate for our economy.
Okay, well, unless we de-link, we're stuck with that, aren't we?
Absolutely. And we're stuck with volatility in the property market as a result.
Mm. Eric Lee, do you agree?
Absolutely. I think when we look at property prices, interest rate is a very important factor, particularly mortgage interest rate. I also happen to be a independent non-executive director of a bank. We've seen mortgage rate drop to a historical low, I think, in Hong Kong or worldwide. I think that helped to fuel the property prices. Particularly, we have maybe about four or five years of economic slump. I think a lot of people losing jobs and they're not buying property. And even the natural demand, I think, for new family being set up, people growing up, or to even change property, I think that's been a lot of pent-up demand. I think that partly explained the sudden surge of property prices and demand in the last year or two. And also, you got to look at the background that we have a booming China market in the last few years, and there's a lot of buyer who's made money from the mainland and all the mainlander themselves coming to invest in the market in Hong Kong. So all these factors helps to boost the short-term property prices. And not to mention also that the property developed nowadays is of much better quality than perhaps 5-6 years ago. So all these actually helps to bring the property prices up. But at the present time, I think I would agree with David that the bubble is not yet evident.
Sorry, that's Peter.
Peter, sorry.
And David,
Peter.
I think there is a bubble.
Peter. I agree with Peter. And I think I'll only start to worry when interest rate start to climb to a reasonably high rate at the end of the, perhaps in the middle of next year.
Okay, well,
for another year or two.
Do you agree that there is this boom and bust cycle and it's unhealthy? The property market just expands, bursts, and slump negative equity, and it's just like that.
Well, there'll be cyclical movement of prices as long as it doesn't go in a way in a very dramatic sort of cycle. It doesn't sort of go boom and bust in a major way. Then it doesn't matter. I think people do expect prices to go up and down. It's been natural of any free market with which is dictated by free supply and demand.
But is it too volatile?
In the last few years, it's certainly been, but that's partly because the government intervened. And to take on David's earlier remarks, it's partly because the government has artificially increased a substantial amount of supply. At one time, I worked out that people like KCRC, MDRC, and the public housing together supply something like 70% of the total market supply at one point in time. Then that doesn't need much room for a free market, because these developers mainly sell the property for funding their own needs or social welfare need. They are not really a free market player.
Right.
Well, the government has moved in two different directions. First of all, there was the $85,000 units per year target, Tung Chee Hwa, early in his administration, which drove these various projects, including the MTR and KCR. And then during the slump, they turned around and turned off that tap and stopped sales of the Housing Society and Housing Authority units. And consequently restricted supply. So that's exacerbated the boom-bust cycle. But I think that I have to disagree with Peter. I think that we are in a property bubble now, and I don't think that the luxury sector, which you cited in the newspaper, is isolated from the mass market. If there's a bubble in the luxury sector, there's probably also a bubble in the mass market. They don't tend to be independent of each other. That's why I rent my property at the moment. I'll be happy to buy if prices look reasonable at some point, but they're far from reasonable now.
How do you know it's a bubble?
I don't know for a fact, but I think history will prove me right.
What makes you think it's a bubble?
Because the capacity to pay rent has not increased anywhere near as fast as capital values. And that's quite a big factor, because ultimately somebody has to occupy these properties and they make a choice between either buying them or renting them. And the salaries that we pay people haven't gone up 80% since the slump, since the bottom of the slump. So I disagree that affordability...
But it hasn't stopped people putting up the rents. So at what point does it become a problem?
Rents have gone up, but not by 80%. I just feel that when you're only getting 2.5 to 3% yield in terms of rent divided by capital value, and out of that you've got to pay for maintaining your property, retiling the walls every 10 years, and eventually redeveloping it, that doesn't leave enough relative to the cost of simply renting the place and letting someone else deal with that.
I think the property market player normally look at the second-hand market, at the secondary market. I think if that shows signs of support, I think that shows that the market is not really sustained by a bubble. I think in recent times, and we've seen a very active secondary market for secondhand flats. I think that's a sign that there's some real demand out there.
I think this whole issue on affordability is the key to whether you're in a bubble or not. If you look in the UK and the US right now, the ratio of average house price to average household income in the UK, typically it's about 3.5 times over the very long term, over 50 years. It's been running at nearly 6 times right now, and in the US it's even more than that. Now, I'm a great believer in the reversion to mean theory, that when you get economic variables like this, which are way out of line with the long-term average, they will revert to mean. And this is where we're at the moment in Hong Kong. 2 years ago, our affordability levels in Hong Kong were the best they have ever been in 30 years that I've been collecting the data for. We're now reverting to mean. We're still one standard deviation away from the long-term average in terms of affordability. Affordability is getting worse as prices go up and interest rates go up, but we're still one standard deviation to the good side of the long-term average. So I think there's still, I don't think we're in a bubble in terms of inaffordability of housing right now.
But is the bubble only a problem if you're trying to make money out of your property? If you're living in it? Like you said, Peter, that you've pretty much got back to the rates that were around before the last fall.
I think bubbles in any commodity or any asset class are when your pricing of those assets is way beyond the long-term averages. For example, in the stock market, this stock market typically trades on a price-earnings ratio, say, of 13 or 14 times. When we're trading at 25 times price-earnings ratio, you're in a stock market bubble. And when we're in an affordability situation in Hong Kong or in the UK or wherever, where the average house price is 7 or 8 times average household income, when the long-term average is, say, 3 to 4 times, we're in a bubble. We're not in that situation here yet.
Christopher Mills, do you want to comment on that?
I think my colleagues here sitting with me are in a much better position to talk about bubbles than I am. But I do think we shouldn't be looking back and getting bogged down in history. I mean, okay,
it's in your interest.
85,000 and all that business.
Yeah. I mean, it's in your interest, as you say, you want to sell the lots for as much as possible. It's in the government's interest to have high land prices, isn't it? Because they get more money.
There's no engineering going on. I mean, if there's a high land price, there's a high land price, and that's dictated by other parties, the people in the marketplace. So be it. It increases government revenue as a side effect of
If you restrict the supply, if you sell less, the price goes up, doesn't it?
It's not up to us how much we sell. We've got 35 sites available. We could get applications for 35 sites, and there'd be an auction, a mammoth auction, in 6 or 7 weeks' time.
Well, you don't put everything on the application list always, do you?
We put as many sites as possible to give as much choice and give the market as much opportunity as possible.
And you set
this time 35 is a substantial number.
And you set a triggering price. So you set a minimum price.
We set a very reasonable level triggering price. As you can see, the trigger price from the site in February, the trigger price was 1/3 of the final sale price. And even in the auction just happening this week, there were 70%. Higher. The sale price was 70% higher than the initial trigger price. So how you can't say that the reserve is too low. It's too high.
It's pretty hard, to fault the government's land sales policy these days with this very open, transparent application list system. It kind of works. But having said that, though, David made the point earlier that the scale of property development and the ability to front up with $4 billion Hong Kong dollars or whatever it takes to buy these sites really limits the scope of the available applicants, and I think that is an issue. And our government has tried to respond by introducing smaller sites and so on, but it is an open market. The system is very open. It's up to whoever wants to look at these sites and to put a bid in and trigger it. It's a market driven system, and I think that's probably appropriate.
All right. Well, I've had an email from Simon again, focusing, I guess, on the losers in all this. He's talking about larger flats. He says, why should people have to live in 400 to 700 square foot flats? There's plenty of land that could be released and the government taken out of the market. If we opened up the Parklands, Victoria Harbour, Lammer and Lantau, tens of thousands of new flats could be created at a larger size than a shoebox. What about all the single people that can't afford to live in their own place because the property prices are too high? Let's get more people into their own places and bigger places for existing families. Eric Lee, do you have sympathy with that?
Well, of course, that would be ideal, but I think the last couple, although we don't want to be bogged down in history, but that's a limit as to how much property developers would put in the market at any point in time. I'm not really just counting the number, but the investment. If we that's a sort of size of how much revenue and how much money people can be plowing back for redevelopment. It doesn't mean that the government put up more land, there'll be automatically more people having funds to bid for it and be able to develop it and eventually be able to sell it at a price that they want. It doesn't really work that way. So in a way, the market really dictates the pace and not the government.
Well, an interesting thing here on the size issue, and Hong Kong is quite remarkable in that sense. We've got one of the highest per capita GDP in the world, but some of the worst housing standards in the developed world. And if you look at even at China right now, in Hong Kong, we've grown up with a culture of the 500 square foot apartment. If you tried to build 500 square foot apartments in China, you wouldn't sell them. The minimum in China that families will buy is about 1,000 square feet to 1,100 square feet. And this is in a culture, in a country, which has 1/20th of the per capita GDP that we have here in Hong Kong. So the market and the people living in Hong Kong have accepted this 500 square foot culture. People in China do not. It's that simple.
But they've got quite a lot more space in China, haven't they, than we have in Hong Kong?
You wouldn't say that looking at Shanghai right now with high-rise buildings sprouting up like mushrooms after a rainstorm. There is certainly more space. There was a study done by the Department of the Environment here many years ago looking at the capacity of Hong Kong to absorb population. At that time, this was back in the early 80s, they studied this and found that Hong Kong, without even reclaiming any more land from what they had at the present time, could house 11.5 million population readily in its existing developable site. So there's no absolute shortage of land in Hong Kong. It's just that we choose not to use it.
You can always take more out of the harbour as well. And the areas around Lantau, for example, Disneyland is 280 hectares, so seven times the size of West Kowloon. So you could probably put 250,000 people on a piece of land that big, and that kind of site can be created several times over in the remaining coastline that we've got.
We're not allowed to anymore, are they?
Only in Victoria Harbour. You can do what you like in Lantau.
Okay.
Under the current legislation. But I think that there is an aspect that we haven't touched on, which is population growth, because there are two ways in which demand for housing can be affected. One is if you make larger flats more affordable, so the number of square feet per household goes up, and the other way is to increase the number of households. Those are the two of the key factors that affect the equation. But if we pursued a larger property policy, that would have to mean releasing more land onto the market faster and devaluing the smaller properties that are out there today, which might not be that popular with the people who own them.
Christopher Mills, does the government think about the quality of life, the flat size, basically, when it's considering its land policy, land sales policy?
In terms of land sales, we don't really have any regard to flat size. We talk about the gross floor area, and it's up to the developer to produce the flat size according to the location and the market in that area.
Mm.
Okay,
we're in a funny situation, aren't we? You recognise that, as you say, we're very rich, but we live in tiny little boxes.
It's partly a consequence of the public housing scheme, because there's been, since it was necessary to produce public housing for immigrants in the last 40 years or so, the government needed to differentiate between the private sector by making sure that the public sector housing was of a lower standard, that it had that the flats were smaller and of lower quality, in order not to crowd out the private sector. So as a consequence, half the population lives in these fairly cramped units. The private sector developers are very obviously increasing the size of properties that they develop, because per square foot they get paid more for them. You get roughly twice as much per square foot for a large flat, 2,000-foot flat or 1,500-foot flat, than what they're being paid for 700-foot flats. So you will see the private sector developing larger flats to meet market demand. But we have a legacy of public housing, which the government is gradually trying to get out of by, once it's sold its remaining housing home ownership scheme inventory, it's trying to stop more of that. I think that's the right way to go. We need to encourage people to occupy private property.
Okay, we've had a call from Rebecca, and I will direct this towards Mr. Mills. She says she wants to know whether there's a second-hand market for land sales. At the moment, there seems to be sales for undeveloped land. What about buying land with old buildings on it? And after developers buy that land, are they then allowed to sell the land on to other developers?
There's a private market in redevelopments. If a private landowner has a lot with a building on it, he can sell on, and another party can come in and redevelop under the existing lease. In terms of government land itself, we sell it as a virgin site, and we expect the purchaser to then go on and develop it.
Okay.
There is a process for compulsory purchase, which has been made easier through legislation. Now, I think if you purchase 90% of the floor area of a building, you can compulsorily buy the other 10%, and then you can redevelop it. That wasn't as easy in the past, and it slowed down the urban renewal process greatly. I think now probably the right balance has been struck, although some developers are calling to reduce the threshold to 80%. I think that would go too far because it would infringe on the rights of the minorities. The process is better now, and I think we'll see the results flowing through from that in terms of redevelopments of private sites happening in the next few years.
We've had a call from Nathan. He says, as it stands now, there's no capital gains tax, no sales tax, no annual net worth taxes. The government's been relying on land sales for its revenue far too long. It's time to think of alternative ways to bring in revenue. We should move away from buying and selling of land as the main source of income. That comes from Nathan.
I mean, with the capital gains tax, wouldn't that stop the boom and bust a bit? That would slow it down a bit. Peter?
Probably not. I think the key tax modification that we're looking at in Hong Kong. Well, not so much that is really going to a VAT system, and that's really the one thing I think that
sales tax.
Same as we've got in most other countries in the world. Singapore introduced it a couple of years ago, and that will lessen the reliance on property and property. I agree with David that property prices in Hong Kong, high prices, are effectively a tax, and the government takes this revenue in the one hand, and then builds public housing to provide for people who can't afford to pay the high property prices. So it's a transfer from the rich in the community and the business community to the poorer people in the community.
But a very inefficient one, because the landlords, the tycoons, take out quite a big chunk in profit in the way.
Mm. Eric Lee, you'll comment on that?
Well, I think I do regard land sales as a form of tax. I said that publicly many years ago, I think. But I think given all that, I think people of Hong Kong now have more choice than ever. I think we can have a small flat with a very good club facility with a very modern lifestyle. We can go for a second-hand market for a bigger flat. And many have actually chosen to go to the China market to buy a different lifestyle there. I think we are given a lot more choice than before. I think that's more important.
I say you're basically happy with the system at the moment, Eric.
Well, I think the system seems to work now. Mm. I wouldn't be too worried about it right at this point in time. If in 2 years' time, interest rate goes up and the sort of pent-up demand is already satisfied, if the prices still goes up, then I'll start to get worried.
Right. Eric, thank you very much indeed.
All right, and thank you to all our guests this morning. It brings us to the end of our back chat show this morning. Thanks to Christopher Mills, Assistant Director at the Lands Department, David Webb from website.com, and Peter Churchhouse, the Director of LIM Advisors, and to our callers and emailers.
Leaving now with the weather forecast, mainly fine today with one or two isolated showers, maximum temperature 30 degrees. That looked mainly fine for the rest of the week, 26 degrees at the moment, with a relative humidity of 87%. The air pollution index forecast for today for general stations, medium to high, and for roadside stations today is high. That's it for us today. Tomorrow, we're going to be talking about Google.